In a world where three pudgy middle school history teachers discuss random aspects of history.
That's all I got.
Oh, Hatfield, we got you.
Yeah, wait, who you calling pudgy?
Yeah, man, that's kind of rude.
No, I'm rude.
It's the History Bros Podcast.
It's that time again. Time for History Talk on the History Bros with your co-hosts, Jason Rude, Jason Hatfield, and Brian Geldmacher. And today we are taking on the topic of the Chinese Exclusion Act. And we might touch on the Japanese internment during World War II a little bit. But Hatfield, this is a topic that you kind of brought about. And it's one that I know you've studied a little bit. So I'm going to go ahead and kind of let you introduce the topic and kind of lead the conversation here, but I'm excited to hear what you know.
Okay. Well, I thought that we would talk about the Chinese Exclusion Act, and maybe if we have time, touch upon the Japanese internment.
Now, it seems like that's repeating ourselves there.
No, you just told me to introduce the topic.
Oh, so. I'm sorry. You're right.
You,
okay.
You did it already, but I figured I'll just do it again.
Well, I'm known for repeating myself.
I figured, so this has kind of been kind of mulling around in my head lately with, of course, you know, the coronavirus starts up over a year ago. And I think we've talked about this online or on the show a few times where people started, you know, it started becoming like a very politically charged topic. I think some of it probably had to do when people were kind of criticizing the Trump administration's handling of it, for which then, you know, Trump supporters and Trump himself sort of came back out and sort of started pushing back, and kind of then it became, instead of a scientific like this exists or doesn't exist, it became a very politically charged issue. And part of that, I feel, came from, instead of referring to it as the coronavirus or as COVID-19, they, you know, people started calling it the Chinese virus.
No, the China virus.
The China virus, and which, I mean, to be fair, it did originate, at least that, to the best of our understanding, and, you know, 2, 3, 5 years from now, maybe we'll have more information on that. But you had, you know, it did originate in Wuhan, alleged from some sort of bat involvement. But then you start having, it's called the China virus, or of course the more derogatory Kung flu.
Yep.
Which I'm still kind of shocked that that was actually thrown about in official, like, you know, news conferences or, you know, rallies, right, and stuff. But then, because of that, and because of, the stigma. I mean, some people were trying to say, well, you know, the Chinese people brought it here, which I don't think is true. But there was a lot of, you know, stigma against, people of Chinese ancestry, or really, really even Asian ancestry in this country, to the point that recently, within the past couple months, there have been attacks on Chinese people. One of them, my personal favorite, had this elderly woman who actually beat the hell out of the guy that had attacked her. And he actually, I think, wound up getting, she was hurt pretty bad, which was bad. But he got taken out on a stretcher and arrested, which I think was glorious that he sort of got his comeuppance, and rightfully so. But this has damaged a lot of people of Asian ancestry's lives right now. And of course, you've got the whole movement of Stop Asian Hate, and they've been trying to pass some laws to more or less criminalize, you know, hate, violence on, you know, people of Asian ancestry, especially, I guess, of Chinese ancestry. But it kind of made me think, you know, of other times in our country's history where we have not been overly great for various reasons towards, in this, you know, specifically the Chinese, which we were much harder on the Chinese before we were as such with Executive Order 9066 with the Japanese. But some people have never even heard of the Chinese Exclusion Act.
Right.
And I thought that that would be, it was a very timely to kind of bring that topic around, since this is this has been going on, because this isn't the first time that we have been sort of hard on Chinese immigrants, or even, you know, well, specifically in this case, it's Chinese immigrants, but some of these people that are being attacked aren't necessarily Chinese nationals.
And it, that's exactly it. Is it? Obviously, we've got issues with people that look different than, say, the mainstream or the majority at the time, or at this point in time, I will say, in the United States, are being treated differently and poorly. And like you said, it's just not the first time it's happened, you know. And the thing about it is, particularly in the case of the Chinese, and I don't know if we're going here, but I'll put it on record at least, we owe a lot of the expansion of the West to those Chinese immigrants, and I mean Chinese because that's where most of those guys were coming from, who built the Continental Railroad from the Pacific side through the mountains.
Oh yeah, they were given incredibly dangerous tasks. I'm not exactly sure. I don't know what the numbers are.
Right, but I mean, it just
because, you know, they would have to blast through mountains and do this kind of stuff, and Chinese immigrants, you know, came over. They weren't forced to do those jobs, but these were some of the jobs that, you know, they were given. But we're talking. Well, I've been taking one of the kind of professional development courses through the Gilder Lehrman Institute, and they actually touched upon this today. I'm taking one on the history of American immigration. And prior to the 1880s, there really wasn't any federally mandated control on immigration. It was basically left to the states. And in around 1882, early 1880s, the federal government started saying, okay, well, we've got a lot of, you know, immigrants that are coming into here. It's labor, it's economy. And we need to sort of regulate the economy. And like, for example, some of the states, New York specifically, a majority of your immigration was coming through there. And this is, of course, you had Castle Garden that had opened in 1847, which was a precursor to Ellis Island. But the federal government started stepping in to kind of go, okay, well, we need to try and control this stuff. But one of the first ways that they did it was by issuing the Chinese Exclusion Act. And what's kind of sad about this is that this act would remain in effect until World War II. I think specifically 1943, and it would still have repercussions until the 1960s pertaining to Chinese being able to kind of own property, own businesses, that kind of thing.
Right.
So, which is kind of weird because, you know, especially that we were so harsh on the Chinese at a time when the Chinese were our allies in World War II.
So I think there's two things we have to explore here. First off, and hopefully you've got it pulled up because I don't, an actual copy of what it says or a summary of what the act itself says. And then number two, I think we need to look at what is it that was trying to be accomplished? Because again, you don't just make, I mean, yes, legislation gets made for bad reasons, but like there's a reason why somebody said, yes, this is why we need to do this. And I think we should try to dig into to and figure out why the heck we would do that.
Well, I think as with anything, through the course of our, I teach the Chinese Exclusion Act every every year, and I'm trying to get the actual, here we go. That's the worksheet. I teach this every year because, I mean, essentially, you find this time and time again in the 1840s when you had a large percentage of Irish that were coming over because of the potato famine. You had the Irish that were considered to be sort of the unclean, you know, kind of outcast troublemakers. And as other groups, other waves have come over, people that have already been living here, and it gets even more interesting because, well, when you have other waves of people coming here, then you have, oh, well, they're trying to take our jobs, or a lot of times there's a fear or anger that a lot of these immigrants that come over here work so hard and essentially can even be more successful.
Right.
Than, you know, people that are already here. So there's some animosity concerning that. But what's also kind of, and this isn't for one particular group altogether, but immigrants that come over here, even at some point, get a little frustrated at other immigrants that come over here. And it's like, you know, it's okay for us to come over. And it's always been kind of interesting for me because I did a research paper for, and I don't know if we talked about this or not, but when I was getting my master's, where I was discussing the impact of American culture on specifically Asian immigrants. Because, you know, there's a stereotype that they come they come over and they're so good at math and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And the fact is that when your first wave of any group from another country come over, like I've taught kids whose parents immigrated over here, either from Central South America. I've had some from Africa. And they put a large amount of pressure on their kids to succeed for various reasons.
Right.
Either because of where they came from and how it's different here. And so there's, and in some cases, it kind of can get other groups a little fidgety about it.
Well, it's intimidating.
But then you also have people that have been here for a while of all different, you know, colors. Who also don't, you know, try to do well in school at all. And I was like, I wonder if what happens as the generations pass, is there some sort of aspect of American culture that that makes people become lazy almost?
Well,
I'm not trying to say that this is only for like Asian immigrants or you know, South or Central American immigrants. I'm just talking about in general.
Yeah, no, I know, and I actually have a very good firsthand document. I got to pull it up from my website. I got to figure out where I've got it.
And also, when I went to Japan, the work ethic that they have there is ridiculous.
Right.
I mean, like people that are like working in a department store. They're dressed in a uniform. They are very neatly, you know, dressed and, you know, hair, you know, all that kind of stuff. And they are standing there at attention in a various location in that store waiting for someone to come up and ask them for help. They're not standing behind the register on their phones. They're not, you know, even going to a Kentucky Fried Chicken, for example.
Oh, yeah.
I went in there and, you know, and I mean, you go to some, you know, Kentucky Fried Chickens and it's just kind of like, you know, whatever, just, you know, take it and whatever. But these, I mean, it's a very deep bow. They take your order and then they go bring everything. They put it neatly wrapped on the, you know, counter. They take a very deep bow. They thank you for coming. And it's just an incredibly polite society. And when I came back to the United States, I flew into Detroit. And it was like, hello, welcome back to America, because the level of politeness and whatever had dropped off considerably.
Yeah. So there's two things I want to bring up with that. And we kind of rapid fired me here. And that's OK. The first thing is a documentary called American Factory. And it's about a Chinese company that chose to purchase a shut down automobile factory. I forget if it was a Ford or GM plant in Ohio, over on the eastern border of Ohio. It might be Lorain. Okay. I can't remember for sure. But anyway, the company came in and they wanted to make their glass in the United States. And basically, the Chinese were going to run it with the intention of, I think, cutting down on costs on importing, essentially. And it was kind of done as an experiment, so to speak. And so the story that it tells is how it's a clash of cultures, but it's not just the culture of like what you eat and how you look and that type of thing. It literally goes down to how they work. And so in the United States, we have embraced workers' rights. We've embraced the 40-hour work week. We've embraced, you know, making sure that we can still enjoy life, make a living while still enjoying life. And what they described was in China, people would literally move away from their homes to go to work at a factory. They would work 12-hour days like it's no big deal. And so when these Chinese managers would come over and they would ask the Americans to work, you know, 10-hour days, 12-hour days, or keep doing things or not have certain safety precautions put in place, they would get all kinds of pushback. And then there was an argument over whether or not they should unionize. And so there was people that wanted to unionize. The Chinese were videotaped, you know, talking about how they need to make sure that it doesn't unionize, or otherwise they're going to pull out. And they put out a lot of propaganda, quite frankly, of how the union is bad for the worker. And obviously there was propaganda put out about how the union was good for the worker by the potential union. And so my thing is there's legitimately a clash of cultures in every aspect between Chinese Americans and Chinese Americans, the whole thing. And so I can understand where some of this tension comes from when, you know, you're introduced to each other. And it's not just how you look that's different. That's a factor, obviously, and it's played out that way many times. But it's literally everything else about the culture and how they act and how we act. And I don't want to say like a we versus them, but how you know, the two sides interact on their own terms, and now you're going to put them together. It makes for a reality show type thing.
Well, there is... I can't speak so much for, I mean, I do know some history of Chinese. Obviously, my specialty is more in Japan.
Oh, we never would have guessed that.
But there is some similarities in terms of, and I think a lot of it has to do with Confucian teachings and whatnot about reverence for authority and, you know, elders and that kind of thing. Because in Japan, some of the students that I would teach, and we're talking, you know, when I'm saying students, they could range anywhere from, you know, 4 or 5 years old to like in the 60s. And I had one student in particular that we were discussing, and they were asking, you know, why do Americans change jobs so many times? And it was like, in some cases, you know, either they're finding something that's a better paying job, or maybe they get laid off because of, you know, various things. And this was a concept that was very, at least at this particular point, this is 2003, that was very odd for them, because in the experiences that I had with the students that I taught, they work really hard in school and very regimented. And then they get to basically eighth grade, and then they have to study for basically an SAT in order to get into a good high school.
Right.
And you have to get into a good high school, because if you don't get into a good high school, then you can't get into an even better college,
right,
and then work for the company that chances are you may work for the rest of your life.
Right. And make decent money.
But their companies do take care of their workers. They have that obligation.
Right.
Something which I don't think you see a whole lot of in American, which kind of led me into wanting to research this, is that, you know, you have, you know, these immigrants that come over and they're trying so hard, but is there something that's kind of toxic about American culture that sort of makes people lazy, perhaps, you know? Here's a good example of the exact same saying being said in two different cultures. In our culture, it's the squeaky wheel gets the grease, but in Japan, it's the nail that sticks up gets hammered down.
Okay.
And that is, you're essentially saying the exact same thing, but it's two different, it's obviously two different approaches.
Let me try to
sure.
Think about how this might mean, and this is what it means, and I want you to tell me if I'm right or wrong, because you're the experienced one here.
I may not know, but go ahead.
No. You're very experienced in life, Hatfield. So the way I understand it here, the squeaky wheel gets the grease means you make enough noise, you're going to get the attention.
Right.
Whereas if the nail that sticks up gets hammered down, it's basically saying do not stand out. We'll knock you back down to the level of everybody else.
Well, you're not necessarily supposed to stand out more right. so than be a part of a team.
Right.
You know, so yeah. And they're very much like that. I mean, you kind of see that in Gung Ho, in that movie that came out, you know, about the car manufacturing back in the 80s. That sort of, which I mean, is a little over the top, but I mean, there's a little bit of truth to that. I mean, like, that one of the students again that I was talking to was working for this company, had worked there for years, and they were, and he was telling me of this one incident where, that's not something that doesn't, I mean, that doesn't happen. This doesn't happen rarely. So it at least at that point happened, fairly regularly, where you were considered to work X number of hours a week, 40 hours, let's say. And let's say you get to that 40-hour mark, you have to punch out, but you don't leave because that could potentially put the entire team and therefore the company in some sort of disadvantage. So they don't tell you this, but it was kind of expected that you would go and punch out and then you would go back to work. And he told me about that. And now, is that something that's good or bad? I don't know. I mean, if you have a company that's going to take care of you for the rest of your life and give you benefits and, you know, a pension and all this kind of stuff, yeah, okay, maybe you want to go in and give that extra mile. But I don't see that would fly a whole lot in the United States for various reasons. Because, you know, people can get laid off for various things or, you know, that kind of thing. But I guess to kind of bring us back to what this particular topic is, you have that work ethic coming to this country. And then you have people that don't necessarily have that same ethic that feel very threatened at this. And so... So one of the first, as I said earlier, one of the first federal regulations pertaining to immigration became this Chinese Exclusion Act, which was in 1882, which I do have a copy of it pulled up because, again, I teach this every year. The gist of it is that if you are a Chinese of Chinese ancestry that's living in this country, then you can stay. But you, it says that from and after the expiration of 90 days next after the passage of this act and until the expiration of 10 years next after the passage of this act, the coming of Chinese laborers to the United States be and the same time and the same is hereby suspended. And during such suspension, it shall not be lawful for any Chinese laborer to come or having so come after the expiration of said 90 days to remain within the United States. So they're going to pass this act. And then in 90 days, if you're Chinese, you can't come here. And if you get here, then you have to go back. And this is going to last, according to this, for 10 years. And but we know that it lasts until 1943.
And not only that, It also, I don't know if it says, it didn't say it right there, but multiple times, because obviously there's multiple iterations of the Chinese Exclusion Act, as in, like, in subsequent years, it's brought up again. But in most of those, it says that Chinese people are not allowed to become naturalized citizens.
Well, and they do the same thing with Japanese as well.
Right.
Sure.
Basically, the rest of the Exclusion Act says that if a master of a boat tries to bring in Chinese, he can be punished by a fine. Again, this is 1882. Punished by a fine of not more than $500 for each and every such Chinese laborer so brought, and may be also imprisoned for a term not exceeding 1 year. And you know, they also talk about if you are from America, you know, if you're of Chinese ancestry living here, you have to carry around papers essentially. If you leave, you have to have that paperwork and come back. And if you lose that paperwork, you know, then there's all this rigmarole. And this is just for vessels, but they also go into saying that the same thing pertains to coming over land. So if someone tried to come in through, you know, Mexico or Canada, the same would apply. It says that for the purpose of properly identifying Chinese laborers who were in the United States on the 17th day of November 1880 or shall have come into the same before the expiration of 90 days next, and in order to furnish them with the proper evidence of their right to go from and come to the United States, the collector of customs of the district for each and any such Chinese laborer shall depart from the United States, shall in person or by deputy go on board each vessel having on board any such Chinese laborers. And they have to have basically identification of papers and that kind of thing. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, when we consider to be the land of immigrants, that seems incredibly harsh for what we kind of consider this country to be founded on.
So, you brought up the topic of the United States and whether or not it appears to be, and you use the word lazy. And I've got a lesson in which we read an excerpt from a guy by the name of Edward Bach. He's from the Netherlands, and he says, my family had come from a land, the Netherlands, noted for its thrift, but we had been in the United States for only a few days before the realization came home strongly to my father and mother that they had brought their children to a land of waste, where the Dutchman saved, the American wasted. There was waste, and the most prodigal waste, on every hand. In every streetcar and on every ferry boat, the floors and seats were littered with newspapers that had been read and thrown away or left behind. If I went to a grocery store to buy a peck of potatoes and a potato rolled off the heaping measure, the groceryman, instead of picking it up, kicked it into the gutter for the wheels of his wagon to run over. The butcher's waste filled my mother's soul with dismay. If I bought a scuttle of coal, scuttle of coal at the corner grocery, the coal that missed the scuttle, instead of being shoveled up and put back into the bin, was swept into the street. My young eyes quickly saw this. In the evening, I gathered up the coal, thus swept away, and during the course of a week, I collected a scuttle full. The first time my mother saw the garbage pail of a family almost as poor as our own, with the wife and husband constantly complaining that they could not get along, she could scarcely believe her eyes. A half pan of hominy of the preceding day's breakfast lay in the pail next to a third of a loaf of bread. In later years, when I saw daily a scow loaded with garbage of Brooklyn householders being towed to the New York Harbor out to sea, it was an easy calculation that what was thrown away in a week's time from Brooklyn homes would feed the poor of the Netherlands. He says some more, but the whole point here is that here's what I think. When I hear that and when I hear what you're talking about, I think, I don't know if it's necessarily lazy, and maybe it's become that, I don't know, but the United States, North America in general, was founded on the principle of colonies for profit to gain materials to take back to Europe to support Europe, who was running out of resources. What we found, or what they found here, was an unbelievably resource-rich area that has not only industrialized, but has all kinds of natural resources to the point where you can replace stuff pretty easy. I mean, you go to toys today. We don't fix toys. You go buy a new one, right? Because it's cheap and there's plenty of them. So I don't know how that plays in, but I think that's a part of it.
Well, but the thing is that you also take into consideration our resolve in times of global conflict.
Yeah.
Revolutionary War. Not a lot of laziness really going on there, I guess, necessarily. World War II, same thing. I mean, there, you know, even the gold rush where people are going there clamoring to get money and things like that. But I don't know. You have, like, one of the big things is that, you know, people complain that immigrants come over here to, you know, take our jobs. And it was the same thing in the 1880s, you know, concerning the Chinese coming over.
I know that South Park really felt that way.
That who?
South Park.
Oh, yeah.
They took our germs, right?
But no, but the thing is that, you know, but it's like it's you don't see, you know, a lot of immigrants coming over and then becoming, you know, CEO of Amazon. I mean, that's not the kind of jobs that they're taking. And typically the jobs that they do wind up taking, like, you know, housekeepers and, you know, migrant workers and that kind of stuff are the kinds of things that you don't see a lot of Americans really banging down the door to go out there and do.
And I would mostly agree with that statement, except for the fact that Andrew Carnegie was an immigrant and the Rockefellers were immigrants.
Well, that's what I'm saying. There are instances in our history where you have people that have come over and have done very well. I mean, the Vanderbilts.
Yeah.
I mean, he had started basically a ferrying business in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And then he kind of switches over to the railroad. Boom, it explodes. And then his son winds up creating building essentially the Biltmore Estate, which is in Asheville, mm-hmm. which is one of these like iconic buildings, these massive buildings.
It's called a mansion.
Do what?
It's called a mansion.
Well, I don't even know if you could call this a mansion. I mean, this is like a castle. I mean, I'm not even joking. It's amazing. But anyway, so, it also, and as you were saying, Rude, section, 14, that hereafter no state court or court of the United States shall admit Chinese to citizenship, and all laws in conflict with this act are hereby repealed. So they were taking away any sort of state, initiatives to grant such, you know, citizenship or abilities to reside here. It was pretty harsh. And again, this will last longer than 10 years. We know it will last until 1943, until it's repealed. But then even at that point, the Chinese are not allowed to, I think, own property, or I think maybe even be able to have citizenship until, I believe it was around the 1960s. Yeah. I would need to double check on that.
And what's amazing about this is not only do you have the initial act there in 82, but 10 years later, the Geary Act of 1892 comes out and does the same thing. It gets challenged in court and is upheld by the U.S. courts in 1893 and 1902. And then we're going to see another Immigration Act in 1924 that essentially continues ineligibility for Chinese and American-born Chinese families to be citizens until 1943 and with the Magnuson Act. And from what I'm reading here, the only reason it went through is for the sake of morale within the country during the war.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, as we had talked about, we were allies with them.
Right.
And, you know, to kind of prevent them from coming over during this time seems a little strange, and the thing is that this kind of exclusion isn't necessarily specific to the United States.
Right.
The in Japan in the 1630s, they implemented what's known as or becomes known as the Sokoku Edict, which is basically expelling any foreigners and not allowing any foreigners at all to come in, except they did do some trading with Koreans and Chinese. But if people like landed on, you know, a random beach, you know, the local magistrate would come out and oftentimes, if not expel them, would execute them on the spot.
Jesus.
So it's not, you know, this isn't something that's necessarily specific, but it is something that we as Americans want to feel like that we have a higher bar set, that we, you know, have, I guess, a higher, I guess, or different, better, whatever, moral compass. And but our history does typically tend to kind of go, well, I'm Minuten bitter, you know, but.
You know, I think... I don't think we can sit here and say, well, today's generation, we need to be guilty. I think it's important, like you said, we need to know this stuff in today's society so that we don't go thumping our chest saying we would never do that, because we did, you know. And so we have talked about the Holocaust on this show more than once. And certainly the three of us have talked off the air about the Holocaust a number of times in a lot of different contexts. But one of the things we would, I think, all sit here and thump our chests and say, yeah, we wouldn't do that. And I don't necessarily know that we want to go into Japanese internment, but that's essentially what we were doing, was putting people in camps. We weren't necessarily killing people, but our country did round up people and put them in camps during World War II because they were Japanese.
Okay, well, let's put a little... Now, there is a little bit of a context difference between the Chinese Exclusion Act and Executive Order 9066.
Yes, Executive Order. You're absolutely right. And I'm not trying to completely shift gears and make it the same thing.
Right.
But it's just that, I mean, that idea of, you know, we wouldn't do that. I get that, you know. Yeah,
right.
Did.
And I'm not trying to justify either one of these, but just for the people who may not be overly familiar, Executive Order 9066, Franklin Delano Roosevelt issues this order as a means of reacting to a very to a fear that there would be Japanese along the West Coast that would be sort of spying or sort of creating an opportunity for another attack like what had just happened in Pearl Harbor. And so it created what were called military zones where certain individuals could be excluded from those areas, meaning that they could be removed, whether they lived there, had a business there, whatever, they could be removed. Now, you don't see this happen for Italians. You don't see this happen for Germans. But you do see it happen for Japanese, which is it's important to note. But they were forced to sell belongings, sell their homes, or, you know, because they had no idea how long they would be gone. And oftentimes when they did come back after all this was said and done, people did not want them to be there because there was such a strong stigma, and understandably so, because of the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
Now,
and so that's not
to blame the individual. I mean, you can't paint a group of people with a broad brush. Brian just had mentioned he's had, for those of you wondering why Brian is peculiar, why he's so quiet today, we're having some technical issues. In fact, he just dropped back off again. He did just send a message saying that the Germans did face discrimination in World War One, and that is true. I know that UNC, I believe it was UNC Chapel Hill, at least some of the universities in North Carolina refused to teach German in the universities because that was considered to be the language of the enemy. And you did have some people. I had family that came over that changed their last name. My grandmother's maiden name was, not her maiden name, but her family's, I believe, maiden name was Freund, and they changed it to Friend.
Yep.
So there were instances where you did have some Anglicization or whatever of names to kind of steer that away. But But in World War II, despite the fact that we were at war with Nazi Germany and, you know, fascist Italy and Japan, you didn't see, to my knowledge, that happening to those European factions. But Japanese were taken to kind of distribution centers and then sent out to various ones. George Takei, for example, was a kid and lived through a similar situation that he's documented in stage plays. And there was a graphic novel that came out a couple years ago.
So a couple things. Okay. First off, George Takei, yes, he was at one point forced to move to Arkansas and be in a camp there. I do have a message out to that camp to see if we can't get them on to talk about some of the Japanese internment issues. We might just see if we can't take a shot to get George Takei. It's a long shot. It probably won't happen. Kind of like Dave Grohl blowing us off. I tried to get a hold of him, but he said no. Actually, his people said no. Here's my thing, though, on why the Japanese got the treatment that they did. First off, I think, yes, there is a certain amount of you look different than us. And so there's probably a certain amount of straight-up racism that plays a factor in this. I don't think anybody from the time would say, no, that, I don't think they would say that, because I just don't think they would. But the justification I think you're probably going to get is, well, you know, the Germans, they didn't attack us on the mainland. They didn't come over here and attack us. And the Japanese did. So, you know, there's that mental state of things of where you're at with these two.
Well, take a look at after September 11th.
Right. Exactly.
I mean, if you looked a certain way, then, I mean, there was violence in the streets, you know, people getting beaten up and stuff, similar to the, you know, the Stop Asian Hate kind of thing that's happening now. And in World War One, I believe, I think it was World War One, German saboteurs did explode some ordnance, which damaged the, I think it either damaged or was very close to the Statue of Liberty. I think it did damage the Statue of Liberty.
Right. And that's the thing. It's not to say that there was no German attacks or Italian attacks or anything.
Sure.
It's not to say that. It's just that there was a big one that was attributed very clearly to the Japanese. And so, you know, it's kind of like the difference between the person who gives me a pinch in the backside or the person who punches me in the face. Which one am I going to remember more?
So, well, there's an actual, there's a very interesting, I think it's a Creole saying that says, he who hits first forgets, but he who bears the scars remembers.
Right.
Obviously that's in English, but
right.
There's a Creole saying. So I guess one of the things I'm sort of, I guess, so this isn't something that's necessary, this kind of fear or anger or racism or whatever you want to call it, but it's not new, obviously, in this country. But would you say that in the past, I mean, you, the 1880s versus 2020, it's difficult to try and compare the two in terms of sentiment, because I mean, 20 years prior to, you still had slavery in the 1880s. So, you know, there's a lot of things that are going on, but would you say that this kind of behavior would you classify it as racist? Would you classify it as understandable? Would you classify it as justifiable? I mean, how would you, I'm trying to figure out.
My answer to that is yes. I think it is racist. Okay. I think there is... What was the second word description used?
Well, is it understandable? Yeah. Is it justifiable?
I think it is understandable as to why some of it happened. I'm not saying that it's justifiable. I don't think it's justifiable. I think, at least by today's standards. By that standard, I don't know. But by today's standard, no, it's not justifiable. It's understandable to in simply the terms of understanding, saying, yes, I can understand what these people were thinking. Yes, I can understand what they were thinking. I'm not saying that it was justifiable. I'm not saying, yeah, they should have been doing that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you can and tell me I'm wrong. I don't care.
No, I mean, it's just, you know, if we think about what constitutes, you know, the Constitution and rights that people have, we clearly infringed upon the rights of the Japanese Americans during, I mean, because one of the things George Takei talks about that was the conundrum is that when they were in the camps, they were given basically a loyalty questionnaire.
Right.
And in that loyalty questionnaire, there were two questions specifically that really tore the people apart. Whereas one of the questions was, will you forswear all allegiance to the Japanese emperor? Well, a lot of these people had never even lived in Japan. And the other one was asking if you would be willing to serve in the military forces. And here's the thing that always blows my mind about the Japanese internment situation is that they were denying citizenship to the Japanese. They were denying citizenship to the Japanese, but they were asking them to forswear allegiance to Japan. So, and George Takei says, you know, they were essentially asking, you know, our parents who had come over here to basically be people without a country.
Right.
Which is incredibly, ridiculously unfair.
Right.
I mean, I think even in that time period, I mean, I understand it's war. I understand that we haven't made the best decisions as a country when we get slapped with a big historical kind of tragedy. I mean, you know, take a look at, you know, assassination of Lincoln, Pearl Harbor, you know, all this kind of stuff. But here's one of the things that continuously blows my mind is that there was a group of people who did decide to sign up for the military, and they were known as the 442nd mm-hmm. Regimental Combat Team, and they become the highest decorated unit of its size in World War II.
Yes. Absolutely.
They correct. Were fierce. And, yes. You know, they were, of course, sent to go fight in Europe because I don't think they were trusted to fight against the Japanese
right.
in the Pacific. But you had these people that rose up above this kind of, you know, despite the fact that their rights were being taken away, despite the fact that they were treated with suspicion and all this kind of stuff. They rose up and like, just became legendary.
No, to prove loyalty. I mean, they felt.
Oh, he's cutting out again.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I can speak for what he was going to say. He's going to say to prove loyalty. He's absolutely right. These guys were literally fighting to prove that they were not the enemy and to prove that their families were not the enemy and that their friends were not the enemy, that they were just as loyal as the whitest of the white. Guy that was a Scandinavian immigrant, you know, and so that's part of the reason why they were so good. Plus, you know, one reason, there's a myriad of them, but that's one of the reasons, I think.
Well, do you think, and Brian, if you can respond, I'll throw this out to you too. Do you think that you would rise to such an occasion? In the same way, if you were forced out of your home, forced to sell your belongings, be treated with suspicion and, you know, threatened and, you know, put into trains
so
and sent out to these like internment camps and say, hey, were you going to fight for this country?
You get to let us answer or not? Jesus.
Well, I wasn't finished with the question yet.
I know. Okay. Brian, I don't know if he's able to say it. He said Shirley, and I think Leslie Nielsen would say, don't call me Shirley. But
don't call me Shirley.
Yeah. But I agree with him. And here's the thing. I can answer it, and I'm going to answer it the way you shouldn't by asking another question. How badly do you want to live in this country or how badly do you want to live where you live? If you are motivated to be here, then you're going to do whatever it takes. If you're motivated to do things, you're going to do it. If you don't have an option to go back to wherever you your family's roots are, you don't have a whole lot of an option. And
considering that a lot of these that were fighting were American citizens, I mean, they had been born and raised in the United States.
Right, exactly.
But yet they had still had their rights taken away. Now, Brian is putting in our chat, a lot of being an American is doing things on my terms. If it means that I have to prove that I can step up, then absolutely I would do what it takes to prove that I belong. The one thing that I would kind of pose to you, Shirley, is it? If you're saying that a lot of being an American is doing things on your own terms, they had all those terms taken away from them and still asked to serve in that capacity.
Right.
Now, I can be just a spiteful person, but, you know, I kind of feel like if I wanted to go to war, I mean, yeah, I know it's a very noble thing. I admire these people. It's an amazing story. It's one of my favorite stories of this time period of this kind. But I feel like being asked by a country to go fight and die for its protection when they have rounded you up and put you in barbed wire.
See, I don't see it that
is
way.
A difficult thing to
I don't see it that way.
Overcome.
I don't see it that way. I okay. see it as I am sure I'm fighting for the country. But what I'm really fighting for is my ability to have those rights back. Because clearly the people in power do not believe that I or my brethren are trustworthy, are real Americans, so to speak. So therefore, what am I going to do to prove to these people that I am just like them, that I want the same things as them? I'm going to go out and fight my ever-loving tail off as hard as I can to prove to them that I am just like them. I want to be just like them. And therefore, I should get my rights back. Give me my rights back because look what I have done. I have proven I'm just like you. Let me have my rights back. That's what I see it as.
Well, Brian's writing into the chat that he's changed his mind, that he thinks that I'm right. I'm just kidding. No, he's not. He's totally staying on board. He says, I still feel like it's a response to being called out, as if to say I've done nothing wrong and I'm going to prove it. I guess I'm asking, who are you trying to prove it to? To people that are already racist against you?
Yeah.
This is going to possibly change their mind?
Maybe. What else? So who are you trying? So who's in power?
When they come back, there's plenty of signs up in neighborhoods that are, I mean, it's, you can look at these up where it says, you know, Japs need to stay out, move on. This is a white man's neighborhood. There's still a lot of Jim Crow racism that's happening here. You're going and fighting to prove something to people who you may never try. Maybe you're trying, maybe you feel like it's important for yourself to prove it.
How else are you going to prove to people that you are not anti-American and that you're not some type of spy subversing the efforts of America becoming what it is?
Who's an American though in this case?
I get that, and I get what you're saying. You're going there again, and I'm not going to bite on that one. What I'm saying is, what other way is there? They're not allowed in Congress. They can't get into Congress. They're not really being allowed to vote.
Right.
You know, there's no other platform for them to get up and say, look at what we're, you know, look at us. Don't look at what's going on over there. So if you need to see me do something, I'm going to go and fight my tail off. I'm going to go do we're going to fight to keep the United States free and the allies free. And we're going to do everything that we need to do to prove that we are the antithesis of the Empire of Japan that attacked the United States.
But you're not Japanese. You're an American in this particular case. So
I'm not. Right. I am. But if I'm in that situation, that's what I think they're doing.
Well, they are too. I mean, they're Americans as well.
I get that, but they're being perceived as that. So how you're fighting perception. So how do you fight perception? By the way, you're welcome, Kevin Bryant. We're fighting again. I know you like it when we do that.
No, I mean, maybe I'm playing devil's advocate. You don't know. But I mean, it really is. I'm not sure I know very many people that would step out to do that in this particular case, in this particular time. To try and fight the perception of a, you know, people, you're trying to change the minds of people.
Yep.
That are only holding you to something because of how you look.
Yeah, right.
Absolutely nothing that you've never done anything to warrant it. There were never any proven cases of conspiracies or espionage, of convictions of any of these people.
Right. It's the same as social media today is rumors spread and we have perceptions and people that want to think they know a whole lot because they read this or because they logic that in their mind or whatever. Oh, they're Japanese. Therefore, they've got to be spies and espionage and bad people. You're fighting that perception. It's like the guy, let's just say his name's Jason Rood, who was a turd when he was younger and has to fight off that reputation by doing everything he can to try to prove them wrong, to prove the rest of the world wrong, that I'm not the guy you thought I was. They're doing the same thing.
My issue is that I'm coming into the constant issue and Brian saying, come home with medals in your chest. And why end? That doesn't make any sense.
I didn't see that.
See, he's not saying anything. He can't say anything, so I'm kind of making fun. Well, come home basically highly decorated like they were, right, and you're going to prove somebody wrong. But my issue that I keep coming back to is, who are you proving? Who considers themselves to be more American? I guess, what, white people? You're wanting to convince white people to be less racist in the Jim Crow era?
Who's in power?
Well, white people.
All right, there. Then there's your answer. Who's placing the restrictions?
Yeah, but when you come home into a neighborhood, it's not, white people aren't in power. I mean, that's a neighborhood, right? But you have people like the Klan and that kind of stuff, which, of course, the Klan's always been known of having, you know, you're changing their minds. I mean, oh, yeah, that's a good point.
So here's the thing. Where does it start? You're hoping to get some recognition through your government, and you're hoping that they'll put that out in a press release, and now stories about your actions get out into the general public, and hopefully the general public starts changing their perception. Because let's face it.
Hopefully. Hopefully.
Exactly. That's all they were doing. This wasn't a guarantee, but it's the only thing they could do at that point to put themselves in a position to try to improve things. What else are they going to do?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's why I'm saying, and in the time period, now granted, some of the people that did serve in the 442nd said, well, this was just a way to get the hell out of the camps.
And that may be true, too.
And that's, you know, that is a very valid point to make. But it's just kind of like maybe I'm just jaded. Maybe
it's something about living over in that East Coast must be different. I don't know. Here we fight for ourselves in the Midwest.
Yeah. Okay. let's pump the brakes on that one. Thanks, Brian. Okay. He says,
no, it's Brian not agrees with me on that one.
A race thing. In this case it is, but we always want to prove someone wrong when they assume the worst of you or assume something about you based on who you are. But again, I feel like, I mean, it's a huge, I feel like it's unnaturally noble to have a, and maybe this is the case, and I'm just saying it probably is. I'm just trying to find my way, my jaded brain to wrap around it, where you have people who are wanting to prove these people who are only judging them based on their race and because of what they're, because again, remember, Chinese Exclusion Act still in. So, I mean, there's a lot of things going on against people of Asian ancestry at this particular point.
Right.
That they're wanting to go and put themselves in harm's way and do it incredibly well to prove to a bunch of, you know, I'm just going to say a considerably racist, scared group of people that locked them up and took their rights away. Hey, you guys are wrong, on the slightest chance that their minds are going to be changed.
Yes. Now you understand.
And, I mean, and that is a difficult thing for, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I'm so fascinated by these, by this particular story. Because I just don't see many times where this happens in our history.
So I guess my question is, if they're not going to do it for that reason, then what reason they did it? We know they did it. We're talking about it. So if they don't do it for that reason, then what reason do they fight for?
I guess in my mind, it's like, is my life worth risking for people who already despise me for no other reason than how I look?
No, but
there's no excuse. There's no justification that they would hate me personally for anything that I've ever done. And yet I'm willing to go out and die to fight for those people, to fight for the protection of those people.
No, I
consider that to be an incredibly selfless act.
Yes.
And that may be what it is.
It's exactly what it is.
And so Brian says, so they should throw their hands up and say, screw it, we'll just accept your opinions of us.
And he also says, I hate that I'm not able to participate in this. He's got to be just absolutely gnashing his teeth right now. Here's the deal.
I would have to say this is probably the best episode we've ever had.
No, I'd actually that was harsh. Here's my thing. Would I lay down my life for somebody who hated me? Maybe not. Would I lay down my life for people just like me in hopes that their life is going to be better because of what I do? Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's what I think they're doing. And yes, it is that noble act. And so how does me laying down my life for the people that look like me and that are like me and that are my brethren, how does dying or fighting hard or earning the respect of the people that don't like me help? Because they're the ones in power. They're the ones who can enact change. They're the ones who can say, gosh, you know what? We were wrong. They are on our side.
I just feel like over the course of our history, there's been too many times where we've had to try and force people to accept a race for who they are based on nothing else apart from the way that they look. And those people have had to go above and beyond and out of their way to prove their humanity,
right,
to prove their intention.
And it's horse crap.
All of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
For no other reason apart from these people don't like you because they don't trust you because you look like these other people.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. It's a bunch of horse crap. You're absolutely right. And through this argument, whatever anybody wants to believe, that's what we've proven, is that is what it has taken for many people in our society over the last 250 years, 400 years, whatever you want to look at, trying to overcome whatever the situation is.
But we have to keep relearning this problem.
Right.
So we had to do it with the Japanese Americans. And then after September 11th, we started all over again.
Well,
we still have a lot of people who still consider, you know, people of Middle Eastern descent to be suspicious.
Oh, exactly.
Or people of a certain, you know,
but I mean, it started in 1619 with the African Americans. I mean, because they were black. So yeah, I mean, anybody who's looked different has had to deal with this. Jewish people look a little bit different because of the way they dress. And I mean, you can go into the subcultures and start talking about social norms and people that dress differently than the majority.
And African Americans who fought in World War II were still treated in the Jim Crow era, you know, marginalization and stuff like that until 20 years later. And then it wouldn't be another 20 years until after that before the federal government apologized to the Japanese that were interned.
Right.
So it's like, it's frustrating to me.
You're talking segregated units, for God's sakes. In World War II.
Well, segregated units except led by white officers.
Oh, of course. Exactly. Whether it's the Civil War or World War II.
Even the 442nd had white officers. So it's like, you know, I know Brian's going, he's saying, making it better for the, and Brian says it, making it better for those who come after. That's absolutely, I understand that. I totally get that. I'm just trying to put myself in the context of that time period.
Oh, I get that.
And trying to wrestle with, I mean, you can look at it now, 60, 70 years later, and kind of go, yeah, that was a brilliant, noble thing. But the fact that in and of that time, taking such a gamble, not even thinking, not knowing you could come back and still be interned, or, you know, you can come back and whatever, and have people still be incredibly racist. And, you know, and I met a survivor of Pearl Harbor who was, let's say he wasn't entirely appreciative of people of Japanese descent even to that day.
Right.
Which, again, there's so much baggage in dealing with that, because you're in Pearl Harbor, you're fighting for your life, you're running around, you know, and exploding ships and so many people die. That's going to leave a considerable mark on you and on your psyche. And I can understand that, and I can appreciate that. It's just trying to untangle all of that baggage based on the context of the time, the kind of racism of the populace, and all this kind of stuff to try and find, here's a group of people willing to rise up and say, whether you guys prove this or not, whether this ever changes anything in our lives or not, this is what it is that we're going to do. And I find that outstanding. It's just, I can't wrap my brain around that.
I get what you're saying. I get what you're saying. We're saying that they did it, and you're saying, I don't understand how the heck you can put everything aside and do it. I get what you're coming from. And I agree. Yeah, how the heck? It's kind of like the turn the other cheek mentality that we hear so often. They literally turn the other cheek when the worst was being done. I get it, yeah. I mean, I don't disagree with you. I mean, I think we were fighting the same argument just from different ends, and, you know, we find the
connection. And we're facing that same situation now with violence against Chinese.
Violence against Chinese, violence against African Americans, violence still, to a certain extent, against Middle Easterners.
Now, granted, we're not figuring it out. I think you probably have a smaller percentage.
Yeah. Well, for Middle Eastern, yes.
No, I'm talking about for a smaller percentage of people that are being violent, maybe against than there were, say, in the 40s and whatever.
Right. But there's still the snide comments and the jokes that go around. And, you know, we crack a joke here, we crack a joke there, and think, it's no big deal. But every time we crack a joke, it normalizes it, especially if you don't understand the context behind the joke.
Sometimes jokes, I feel like, can disarm.
Right.
Can. Yeah.
But I also think, like, if you go out and use a slang, you know, make a joke about, you know, you always hear the joke, and I don't mean to come off as racist here, because I don't agree with this. But, you know, you'll hear the joke about how do people from China get their names? And they say,
throw
pots and pans down the stairs. What's that do? It normalizes the normalizes this idea of it minimalizes the significance of somebody's name, because let's face it, someone's name is a very personal thing, and it minimizes people's name, you know, something very personal. And then again, it normalizes this idea of we can make fun of it. Now, it may not be much, and, you know, it may not be, you know, I tell one joke and now the world's going to collapse, but you say one here and one more person says, you know what, I think I could tell that joke. And now it goes around and it becomes normalized. And now we move on to the next joke. And it just continues to go and go and go. That's not to say we can't have jokes about stuff, but...
Well, I would be curious to see what jokes there are from other countries about Americans. Now, John Dower has a book called Embracing Defeat, which is about, which is a fascinating, oh my God, it's one of my favorite books. If you get a chance to read it, it's absolutely totally worthwhile. It is about the relationship between Americans and Japanese in Japan in post-World War II occupation.
Sure.
And how the Japanese believed that the Americans were these big, hairy barbarians that were going to come over and rape all their women, essentially.
Right.
And the Americans considered the Japanese, even the Japanese men, to be very kind of effeminate and, you know... not macho or masculine, but they go through, I mean, and it's not just about that. They go through the entire process of dismantling, you know, a fascist government system and trying to institute a more, democratic, process and that kind of stuff. It's called Embracing Defeat, Japan in the Wake of World War II, by John Dower. I can't recommend it enough. It's a fantastic book.
Well, it sounds like you should be reaching out to him and trying to get him for the podcast.
I might do that.
All right.
But so it's just, you know, there's stereotypes, there's racism, and, you know, and it's not something new that's happened in this country. It's stuff that has continued. And it sometimes it seems like we have to keep revisiting it because, as kind of Brian had put on the chat earlier, people don't ever seem to learn from our history.
Right.
And it's unfortunate because, you know, I want to think that our country is bigger than this, that our country is better than this. And it seems like we have to keep relearning it for the slower aspects of our country who refuse to kind of...
Well, and whether they refuse to, or if they just never have the opportunity to be exposed to those stories. You know, there's a difference. There's two types of ignorance. There's intentional and unintentional ignorance. And I can understand unintentional ignorance if you've never, you don't know what you don't know. And so, and that's where us as teachers have the job of telling those stories and including the whole story. Right. And then we start to see some of those things because... if you don't tell those stories, people tend to come back. That's where it happens again. You know, that's where I think that cyclical stuff happens. If you are aware of the story and intentionally ignore it, now that's intentional ignorance, and now you're just a prick. But, you know.
Well, I kind of want to backpedal for just a minute to just ensure that, you know, my view on, you know, the Japanese Americans that fought in the 442nd, that I am in awe of their achievements. I am not trying to denigrate or anything about them at all. I'm just trying to, again, wrap my brain around how somebody could be that noble and selfless in such a time of people treating you with such disdain for no other action apart from how you look, from mere perception, which is infuriating that people will do, oh, well, you know, that person looks like that. They probably must be this way. It's infuriating. It's also, as you're saying, Rude, and I think that's an interesting point that you bring up, this is one of the reasons why it's important that you and I and Brian as well teach these stories. To teach about how these people have done that, to hopefully inspire others to kind of step up. Because, I mean, it has changed. It has caused change. Martin Luther King Jr. Brian was mentioning, you know, he spent time in jail. Granted, he was very well aware that sacrificing himself in such a way would cause damage. I mean, physical damage to themselves. Mm-hmm. Or worse, in an effort to draw attention to the problem.
Sure.
And the, you know, the Japanese Americans did that, you know, during World War II, signing up to, you know, fight in this conflict. It's just, it's fascinating. It's amazing. And it's the kind of stories that need to be told and need to be remembered.
Right.
Because it seems like we have to constantly we have to continue to relearn these stories and these events.
Right. It's not about hating ourselves. It's not about hating each other. Well, it's about not hating each other. And it's also not about hating ourselves. It's about understanding each other. And I'm with you 100% there, Hatfield.
Well, I'm very critical of ourselves.
Well, we have to be critical, but
understand. I mean, I don't hate this country. I don't hate this country. Well, I don't hate the people in this country, but right. I just know that we have the capacity for much, much better, and not every time do we rise up to that. And a lot of times we can. A lot of times we can, but right. There have been some very embarrassing times where we have not, and mm-hmm. That's why social studies is so important.
Exactly. I'm with you. All right.
Well, that was, you know, this is the first time that we've gone really just two people. I want to apologize. I know Brian was out of his mind wanting to hop into this fray. And
that he's bailed on us.
Well, he was having some internet issues,
yes.
And he would, you guys heard it at one point, what he was saying would get choppy and cut off. So I was trying to be as transparent and kind of throw out the things that he was saying in our little chat.
Yep. Yeah. Exactly. And I think it worked out. It worked out.
Yeah.
So, and we got some arguing in there for Kevin. Kevin
right,
likes it when
right.
we argue. So that was good.
Please leave a message in our comments and on our page as to what you would like Rude and I to argue about next time.
There you go. There you go. So I've got something as we close out the show here.
Okay.
Something that I think is kind of neat. The census numbers literally just hit the press. As we are recording this, they just came out. So
great. Even the census numbers are getting violent.
Yes.
Why all this violence?
Now, no fair cheating. We're going to have you take some guesses here, Hatfield.
No fair cheating.
You can't cheat. So don't look anything up.
Okay. Okay.
All right. What do you think the overall population of the United States is after this year's census?
400 million.
Seriously?
Yes.
You're a little high. It's actually 331 million.
Oh, okay. I was originally going to say like between 340 and 350, but I was like, well, it wouldn't be that big of an issue if it was. So I was shooting pretty high.
That's okay.
Wow.
That's right. Okay. So it's not as high as I figured it would be. But all right. So
are we decreasing or are we increasing?
That I need to check on. How about the state of North Carolina? What do you think the new census population for North Carolina is?
I will say between 12 and 15 million.
No, not that high. You overshot again. It's only 10.4 million.
Okay. So it's been 10 million for a while.
Sure.
So I didn't know if it had, and I figured with the housing market in North Carolina as it is, there's got to be a reason why houses are so crazy expensive.
Well, that actually plays a factor in one of the big things. Of course, there's reapportionment that happens with every census, and states gain and or lose representatives in Congress. And North Carolina is one of the states that is gaining a representative.
Really?
You are gaining a representative. California is losing a representative.
Well, that means they have 50. They'll have 54 electoral votes.
Yes.
And Texas. That means we will have 16.
Yes. Texas is gaining two representatives. Two.
Well, I think there's a lot of people that are leaving California after all those fires. I think they're just like, we are done with that.
So
I mean, people have rebuilt and whatever.
People are attributing it to that as well as restrictions on COVID.
Really?
And we're also seeing a certain amount of realignment because of political beliefs within states.
What about Iowa? What about Iowa and Missouri?
Yeah, Iowa pretty well maintained. They're at 3.1, 3.2 million. No change in their representatives. Missouri is still at about 6.1 million, and they are not gaining or losing a representative. Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York are all losing representatives. Florida is gaining. Illinois is losing a representative. Colorado is gaining a representative. Let's see here. Montana has gained a representative.
They must have gotten 15 people in there now.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Oklahoma is losing a representative. Nope, check that. Ohio, I already had that one. Oregon is gaining a representative. And West Virginia is losing a representative. So there you go. Those are the changes as far as that goes. I can look here and see the average population represented by each representative is now approximately 700,000 people.
That what now again?
So the average representative is representing approximately 700,000 people. So Okay. You know how basically if you take the number of people in your state and divide it by the number of representatives that you have.
It's based on for the House of Representatives, yeah. It's based on population.
So
whereas the Senate, for anyone knowing, which is one of the issues with wanting to promote D.C. as a state, which by the way, they're wanting to call it is it Washington Douglas or Douglas Commonwealth?
I'm not sure. I haven't looked close enough.
Yeah. So Democrats in Congress are trying to promote Washington, D.C. as a state without having to go through an amendment process. I don't know how many representatives that would add, but it would obviously add 2 Senate seats because, as we talked about in the past, the House of Representatives done by population, but the Senate was originally designed to benefit smaller states, so every state gets 2 votes. And
sure.
So there's, I think we can go ahead.
Sorry. I've got some percentages here on growth, or losing. There's 3 states in the union, plus Puerto Rico, that lost population, and those states are Illinois. They lost 0.01. West Virginia lost 3.2% population, and Mississippi lost 0.02% population. The biggest gainers, Idaho gained 17.3%. Utah gained 18.4%. Texas is up 15.9%. North Dakota is up 15.8%. And Nevada's up 15%. And for us guys here on the podcast, North Carolina grew by 9.5%, Iowa grew by 4.7%, and Missouri grew by 2.8%.
You know, heaven can only get so crowded.
Exactly. Pennsylvania, Virginia grew 7.9%, Pennsylvania 2.4%. I know we've got some people out in those areas, so... we could crunch these numbers forever, but I thought they were interesting since they came out. I thought, hey, let's break a little news.
No, that's awesome. That's, I had not heard that. So I'm very excited.
Just came out, and, the Rust Belt that was Michigan's losing a seat as well. I missed that one. The Rust Belt that was the deciding factor for the election this year, they're all losing a seat.
Really?
And I don't, it's not a punishment. It's just the way the population is playing out.
Right. No. I understand that. Oh.
Yeah. It's very interesting. Very, very interesting.
Well, you heard it here first, or maybe second or third, depending on when you've listened to this podcast.
Well,
or it
exactly.
could be 2 years from now. Old news.
It could be. It could be, Hatfield. It could be. But nonetheless, the time has come for us to land the plane.
Yes. Well, it's been a spirited discussion. But once again, please like, subscribe, and rate our podcast, as well as reach out to us on our Facebook page, as well as we're on Twitter and Instagram, History Bros Pod. And, you know, give us some recommendations, you know, ask us some questions, you know, reach out to us. Let us know what you're thinking.
If you want to hear a guest or hear from a guest about a topic, let us know. We'll do the research and see if we can track them down. You just send them something to say, hey, you got to do it. Especially to Dave Grohl. Tell him he's going to come on our podcast. Anyway, I haven't gotten him yet. And I really, really want to talk to Dave Grohl. Really want to talk to Dave Grohl, and it's just, I don't think it's going to happen. But anyway, all right. Well, Mr. Hatfield, you have yourself a good one, and I'll have myself a good one. And Brian, wherever the heck you are now, you have a good one, and we'll call it a day. All right.
What?
Oh, he's got. See ya.
Well, peace out.
Deuces.